Hi, I'm Frances Anderton and this is DNA. Los Angeles is seeing an explosion of murals. Would you like to paint one?
This is a new thing that we're trying out, and it's in order to speed up the curation process and give everyone an opportunity to potentially paint a mural with us.
Hear from Ruben Rojas and the movement to beautify Earth later in the show. Let's start, though, by visiting a past that has become newly present at a former armory in Culver City, where a museum has just opened. It's called the Vende Museum of the Cold War, and it's the largest collection of Soviet-era art and artifacts outside of Europe. This museum is the brainchild of Justin Jampol. He's a native Angeleno, and back in 2002, he was studying Russian and East European culture for a doctorate at Oxford University. He was researching in official historical archives, but he felt he needed to look further.
These are just the papers of a government, one that wasn't around anymore. And in fact, it was actually people's histories were in their heads, but also in their closets and their basements and attics. And it felt like I was in the wrong place. I should not be in the archive. I should be out there in the streets speaking with people. And as I did that, I discovered collections.
In people's attics, in landfill, in antique shops.
The Berlin of the 1990s and early 2000s was a very unusual and exciting place. It was very much a place in the process of becoming something else, but everything was like, was falling through the cracks. I met a guy named Alvin Nachtwey, who was one of the first wall peckers who chips the wall down. He stands there and chisels away and sells the little pieces. And he became sort of a mentor in knowing what these artifacts are, where they could be found. And then it became very clear very fast that there were others like me who were interested in food culture. Well, you need menus. You need photographs of food. You need, where do you get that? What about scrapbooks, insights into everyday life and culture? So it seemed not only that this was like, this was an issue where the materials weren't preserved. It was also an issue of like, where do these things go? They're almost like orphaned objects.
Fast forward to today, and Justin Jampol has collected over 100,000 artifacts. His museum is named Vende because that's the German word for turning point or change. And now the museum has gone through a big change of its own. For 15 years, it was housed in a cramped space in a nondescript office park in Culver City. And now they have a permanent home in a space that comes with a nice historic twist.
Well, we are in a National Guard armory that was built by the U.S. Army in 1949 with the explicit purpose of surviving a first strike of Soviet bombs. It has two above-ground bunkers, one for people, one for guns. And it was a place that was supposed to provide shelter for the community. And the reality was, of course, it would have been fruitless. And already by the next year, it was the introduction of the hydrogen bomb, in which case even the reinforced concrete and steel building that this is, it would not have worked. And by the way, there is still an atomic air filtration system inside the armory that we left in place as a relic of another era.
Does it filter out traffic pollution?
No, it probably causes pollution. I made the mistake of turning it on when we first got the keys to the museum, and then it whirred on, and all of a sudden it spat this old 50-year-old dust. It probably took 5 years off the end of my life, I'm pretty sure.
The armory was leased to the Vende Museum by the city of Culver City for 75 years at $1 per year, in return for making it a community facility. And it was helped along by a group of supporters, including art and design book publisher Benedict Taschen and the designer and preservationist Michael Boyd. Now you enter a very open, light-filled, bare concrete building, and you find yourself surrounded by objects like a 1970 poster of a Soviet moon rover, a top-secret map of divided Berlin, surveillance equipment, and a model of the Sputnik satellite. So what does all this feel like to folks who actually grew up in the Eastern Bloc? Antje Weser-Johnson grew up on the northern coast of Germany in a city called Rostock. She recalls the shock to her family when the wall came down and they lost a world that had given them limitations but also security.
It is weird because to me it doesn't feel like artifacts. To me, it is more memories, like, you know, seeing the little puppets we used to have or seeing some of the emblems or the art which, you know, was taught to us and why it was done and why, for example, why all these statues have such big hands, because it was all about the work. To me, it's not an artifact. It's like, oh, I used to have that in my house. Why is it in a museum now?
Do you think there's any artifacts here that are somehow misrepresented or miscontextualized? Because they have a vast collection of stuff, and that stuff includes old teapots, tea towels, menus from hotels, as well as military uniforms, statues of political figures, paintings.
I don't know. I mean, I saw these garden chairs, like the round ones that everybody always talks about as a typical East German design. I've never seen one when I lived in East Germany, one of those, and they keep popping up everywhere, and I'm sure they existed. I just never noticed them before.
Now, several former East Germans also attended the opening party that took place for the Vendée Museum this past Saturday. Inez Garstecki talked to DNA producer Ava Shayatsi. She told him how difficult it was to cross over into the West, but her parents applied for family reunification. And at the age of 13, she and her family moved to Munich.
So the story is, we had my uncle, my mom's brother, lived in West Germany, and we had other friends in West Germany, family friends, and we would get West items sent. So we were the cool kids in the school, and we had, you know, the pens and the erasers and clothes and from West Germany. And then we moved to West Germany, and all of a sudden, and that for me, age 13, my brother was 14, were the poor East German kids that everybody had to feel sorry for. And there was the big shopping malls full of things, but we didn't have the money to buy it. So we would just go for hours and look at all these floors, an hour on each floor, circle around the shopping center to just look at stuff.
So now we're at the new Vendée Museum, and you've had a chance to walk around. Did you see anything inside that reminded you of your childhood?
Yes, many things. Many things, and many things that I saw that I would love to own. There are these, like, painted plates that you would hang on a wall from sports organizations. And then there, in the toy section, there were some hand puppets from a cartoon that we used to watch on TV called Pitti Platsch. And then I realized, like, I haven't said this word in probably at least 20 or 30 years, and realizing, yeah, Pitti Platsch. But yeah, it's this homely feeling that comes up.
So it sounds like you're a little bit nostalgic for that time.
Yes, yes. I mean, seeing all this makes you nostalgic when you grew up there and you don't have it anymore and it doesn't really exist anymore. And now it's in a museum. So I'm happy to be in LA, that something like this exists in LA. Who knew?
That was Inez Garstecki. Angela Thompson was born in Dresden in former East Germany and fled to the West with her family in 1951. She served for a time on the Vendée Board of Directors and doesn't think it's all that strange to walk through a grove of palm trees and suddenly see Cold War artifacts.
I think that Los Angeles is actually a perfect place for that, because before Hitler and during the war and after Hitler, all of the important people from Germany, all the intellectuals, they all came to this country, and many of them came to Los Angeles. I mean, you can just rattle down 100 names of the people who lived here, beginning with Thomas Mann and Bertolt Brecht and Albert Einstein. So Los Angeles is actually the perfect place in this country to have a museum like that.
If you go to the Vendée Museum now, you will find, in addition to former East German puppet dolls and furniture, you'll find a very interesting show called Cold War Spaces. The museum's chief curator is Yu Siegel, and he explains the content.
So we have divided this exhibition in 8 categories. For instance, public space, private space, utopian space, secret space, outer space, border space, etc. To highlight different aspects of socialist life, and also to show how different people and different groups of people used the space in a very different way. To give you an example, in the section on public space, we have ceremonial flags that were used in parades. We have a monument that's a politicized public space, but we also have photographs with punkers in the East Berlin metro, for instance, in the subway. In the secret space section, we have the Baltic Coast Project, which is a series of Soviet maps that delineate the Baltic countries, but leave out certain military strategic spots. And I think that's very funny to have it in this exhibition, because the National Guard Armory building, which was built in 1949, was not to be found on any map either, because it was a secret space.
Also in the exhibition, you will find black and white photos of marvellous examples of brutalist architecture, Soviet style. And upcoming exhibitions at the Vendée will address Hungarian visual culture, the psychological history of the Cold War, and even Soviet hippie culture.
Many people don't even realise that there was such a thing as socialist hippies. But it was actually a widespread movement. The interesting aspect about it is that the former hippies who are still alive and keeping their materials are at an age that they are dying or have recently died. And if we are not collecting these materials, they will be gone forever and no one will actually know about this whole culture.
That's, what kind of materials?
It's a wide range of clothing, jeans that are creatively patched together, music, audio tapes, poems, artwork, all kinds of things.
Did these socialist hippies protest? Did they have the freedom to protest? And what would they be protesting against?
Well, I wouldn't say it was directly political protest. I would describe it as a group of people trying to create their own universe of meaning, of life rituals, of connecting to each other. Completely loose from the official state rhetoric and expectations. They were sometimes suppressed, not because they were overly political, but because they were so different.
The Vendée Museum's relaunch is timely. The US is back in the shadow of the Cold War as a special prosecutor investigates whether the Trump campaign colluded with the Russian government to win the 2016 election. This time, though, the spying and counter-propaganda are taking place in cyberspace. So will the Vendée Museum address these contemporary themes? Back to founder and executive director Justin Jampol.
Well, I think the museum has a responsibility and a chance to really be a forum for civic engagement around so many of these themes that directly relate to the Cold War era. Anybody just has to open up a newspaper or look online, and it's stories of Russia and North Korea and walls and surveillance and spying. And these are very Cold War themes in some ways, but they're contemporary as well. And our mission is and should be different than it was 10 years ago when we were collecting this stuff. Now it's a time to engage, and actually couldn't have come at a better time. I mean, the Cold War is very much still a history in process because the impact is still being felt. This is a history that affected it all from space to design to furniture to industrial design. I mean, these are things that we might not even realize, but that the way that we sort of understand and perceive the world around us really sort of came out of this era.
That's Justin Jampol, and we've been talking about the Vendée Museum of the Cold War. It is free and open to the public. You can see images from their collection at kcrw.com/dnablog. Coming up after this break, a loose collective of street artists is bringing a splash of colour to some rather depressing walls in Los Angeles. Would you like to join them?
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Drive around LA and you'll see murals are everywhere. Do you ever think, ooh, I'd like to paint a wall too? Well, you just might get a chance by entering a call for artwork from Beautify Earth. And what is that exactly? Well, Beautify Earth is a non-profit that started life on Lincoln Boulevard in Santa Monica. Ruben Rojas is an artist and he's co-founder of the group. He came to the station to explain what it does, how you might become involved, and what Beautify means to them.
So it started with just social responsibility, taking a paintbrush yourself to go create change instead of asking someone else, like, for example, the city. Graffiti cover-up. You can write letters. You can complain all day long that there's graffiti, graffiti, graffiti on this wall. It's vandalized. It's dirty. It's ugly. Or as a citizen, you can say, hey, can I come fix your wall? I go buy a gallon of paint, fix it myself.
Is that how it started?
Yeah. Evan Meyer would walk by this really ugly bench. He's the founder of the movement and the founder of Beautify Lincoln, and decided upon himself to get a bucket of paint, paint this bench and make it beautiful.
So he paints over the bench and then he starts with beautifying Lincoln.
Yeah, so it's known as Stinkin' Lincoln, right? So he gathered some of his friends, made a little post, hey, who wants to paint some walls with me? And he started with painting Metropolitan Cleaners and a couple of the other stores up and down Lincoln. And that's how he started spreading the movement of beautifying Earth.
Did Beautify Earth have to get some kind of city approval for this?
No, I think Santa Monica is a little bit different in that sense. I mean, they are stickler for the rules in a lot of things. But when it came to painting murals and painting buildings, it was more, do we have landlord permission and do we have business owner permission? And from there, it was one, two, three. Now we're deeply enthralled in the city. They do support us. They support the work and sometimes help us with matching funding.
Lincoln is a commercial strip. So, and the murals you just listed are all on businesses. Is that what Beautify Earth aims at, is businesses?
Yes and no. We aim for any wall that's ugly, any wall that's blighted, boring, beige. It happens to be the majority of our businesses. And it turns out that way. A lot of these shops, mom and pop shops, they're barely making ends meet running their businesses, paying their employees, keeping up with payroll taxes and things like that. They don't have money to go and beautify the building that they're in. And the landlords, you know, sometimes they don't care. That's not their interest. They just want to collect rent and move on with their day. So we've been able to give them this opportunity, this gift that spreads now throughout the community. And what we've seen is their revenues actually go up. People go in there more. It stays cleaner in front. There's less trash. So they've benefited exponentially, which then benefits the city, which just benefits everybody. It's a ripple effect.
So Metropolitan Cleaners, let's just take that as an example. Do you or Evan or whichever member of your team go to Metropolitan Cleaners, introduce yourself, say, we'd like to paint your wall. They look surprised initially, presumably, but you talk them around. And then do you say, but you've got to buy the pot of paint, sir? Or do you say, we'll pay for the pot of paint?
Ideally, we walk in and they say yes. But we've had a lot of pushback. It's taken a lot of time to get us to where we are. Then we do say, hey, sometimes we have some matching funding, but we want a little bit of your input and skin in the game so that we can, you know, have a fair stipend for the artist, cover all the supplies, keep the organization running. Sometimes they have nothing. There has been many times where I just pay out of pocket. I'm like, I'm just going to do it. Because the opportunity, it's a good wall. It's a good way to spread the mission. So it's a balance between all of that. It's really case by case.
Based on what I've seen of Beautify Earth walls, because they all have a Beautify Earth signature there, mm-hmm. Thematically, they tend towards more being decorative and bright. Is that fair to say, rather than, say, delivering a political message?
Correct. So there's three things we abide by. Number one is we are not to be political.
And why is that?
One thing, we're a nonprofit. So we're a 501c3. We don't know who may be a sponsor potentially, or where we may get grant money from, or who's supporting us. And to keep it open and inclusive to all, we can't choose sides. Also, art is very subjective. So a lot of people don't like all of the art that goes up. So we keep it nothing religious, obviously nothing offensive, and nothing political.
So interesting that you use the word offensive, because that brings me to the question of the notion of beauty. You specifically use the word beautify. If you go to art schools or architecture schools, there is, or there has been, the idea often is to provoke. It's meant to make you feel a little bit uncomfortable. And folks who believe that beauty should provoke will look at a sweet, colorful facade, and they might say that's kind of offensive because it's like blandly pretty.
So we use beauty or beautification as an action. So the action of beautifying Earth. And again, art is very subjective. So we are open. We take your criticism. We smile and say, okay, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing. If you want to get involved, come support us and, you know, let us know what you would like to see. What is your form of beauty? How can you take action?
Does the business owner or the landlord of the building that you paint the mural on get a chance to say yes or no on a design? So they sign off.
Yeah, it's 100% a collaborative process. So we take some of their input. We try to match them with an artist that's going to best suited for that. We take input of the community. So it's definitely a dance.
Right now, as you know, there's a lot of anxiety in a lot of neighborhoods around the issue of gentrification. And it has even come to the point where art is being seen as a cause of gentrification. What do you say to those that worry that the prettier you make a street, the more the house prices might go up?
That's a loaded question. Gentrification, I believe in the context that it's being used now, it's definitely a taboo word. Wasn't meant for that, but it's headed down that way. We haven't experienced it as far as someone saying, no, we don't want you to put up a mural because of gentrification. So luckily we're not having those conversations yet. I'm sure they're going to come, you know, if we paint more and more in Venice and more in some of these concerned communities. But at the same time, we're using local artists. We're using people that live in the community. We are engaging the community with volunteer paint days. So I feel that if we continue down that path of including everyone and staying local and staying true, we can, you know, tote that line.
And also, would one ask, okay, Lincoln, one, we're talking about a commercial strip. We're not talking about a residential neighborhood. And two, this is a commercial strip that really nobody loves.
Those are all great points, right? But I'll answer it this way, and I'll say 40 to 50,000 people drive by this street every single day. There are points in time where you're stuck within two blocks for 30 minutes. Do you want to continue to see blight, ugliness, and what's that going to make you feel inside? Or would you rather see something that's going to be uplifting, positive, that's going to make your community a little bit better?
Okay, so one now drives down Lincoln, and you see some murals and think, that looks really fun to paint that mural. It turns out that the way Beautify Earth works is it does reach out to people who want to get involved. Specifically, you have a deadline coming up, December 1st, for a call out to anyone that wants to enter. Is that right?
That's correct. This is a new thing that we're trying out, and it's in order to speed up the curation process and give everyone an opportunity to apply. So an artist that may have never painted a mural, but obviously they have some art skill and some background, things like that, have the opportunity to potentially paint a mural with us. The difference where we are with maybe some other organizations is that anyone can have a shot. Anyone can paint. We also tell people to go find your own projects. We'll help you through the production of it. Maybe you have partial funding. Maybe you have the wall, don't know how to kind of move forward. We help with the agreement, maybe supporting and walking through permitting processes or things like that, and maybe have some funding that we can give toward the wall. And that's an opportunity for an artist to go out and start on their own. So we're very inclusive and very entrepreneurial in that fact.
You're listening to Ruben Rojas, who's co-founder of Beautify Earth. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Now, the group's entrepreneurialism has taken them into collaborations with companies like Zappos, as well as small business owners and non-profits. And Ruben Rojas has a package of skills that helps with both sides of the mission. By day, he's a financial planner. So how did he get into painting?
I submitted for a competition to do the class logo of my graduating class in sixth grade. And I happened to win. Competition wasn't very stiff because I was the only one that submitted. But the teacher's like, okay, here, now paint this wall. Imagine a wall in an auditorium. You know, it's a pretty large wall. And I'm...
And you're 11.
11 years old. I'm, what, 4 foot nothing? And they're like, you're going to paint that wall now. And I'm like, well, how am I going to do that? Turns out, you know, we got it done. We used an overhead projector. That's how I learned to scale different things. But that was my first mural, and I hadn't done a mural again until about 4 years ago.
Ruben, just take us to one of your murals and describe it.
So one of my murals is the Dreamer mural on the corner of Walgrove and Rose. And the premise behind it is bright and colorful mural, and it says Dreamer. Super simple. So through my art, I just want to trigger something that may remind you as a kid, what was my dream? Why aren't I dreaming anymore? Where did that go? Or maybe you sit in your 9-to-5 every single day and you're dreaming of starting your side business or going to this destination or taking your family here or there.
On Lincoln specifically, one, there were the overhead wires, telephone wires, which are not terribly attractive. And two, there's a lot of billboards. Mm-hmm. So as a muralist, you are competing with the billboards mm-hmm. that are advertising. Do you feel you're in a kind of a visual struggle?
So it's a great question. So I just did a TED Talk on what I do with my work and how I'm competing with the visual urban landscape, right? We see billboards that tell us that we're not good enough, that we need to freeze the fat, that we need to go get gastric bypass, that a big shiny new truck is what's going to help us feel more manly, or a new iPhone, or a variety of things. And if none of that works and you're like, well, I can't afford that, well, I can go drink myself into happiness. So what I'm doing with a lot of my personal murals is trying to give you an opportunity to see your landscape in a different vein. I call it ad vandalism. So, you know, some people say our work is graffiti or vandalism and they don't want it, but advertising is the same thing. I don't want to see that. So that's a little bit of an inferred battle.
You go to architecture school where you learn that a blank white wall can be a very beautiful thing. Would you say that sometimes it can?
Yes. So we're not, there are very specific buildings that are stark white and they're gorgeous. And you're like, that's amazing. You know, go to Greece. It's blue in Santorini. Everything's blue and white and it's beautiful. So we do take into consideration the lines and the design, but there's just a lot of stuff that's older now, and it's just age. So it's more broken window theory that we're trying to, you know, think of a car. It gets a dent. You ignore it. Gets another dent. You ignore it. Breaks a window. You put duct tape on it. This car is now all of a sudden a jalopy. That happens to buildings because people don't care for them. So yeah, brand new building. We're not going to, you know, if it's painted properly and clean, that's not what we're looking at. It's more of the stuff that's, you know, what needs help.
Ruben Rojas is co-founder of Beautify Earth. You can see his work and find out how to submit your own sketches for murals at kcrw.com/DNAblog. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is DNA's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening, and we hope you have a very happy Thanksgiving break. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.